This is One in a Billion with Mabel Chan, a show about China through the personal stories and voices of young entrepreneurs and other enterprising types. These are American-educated, globally-minded Chinese millennials making big, bold moves, crossing borders and cultures, looking to better themselves and benefit others. What moves them? What drives them? How do they want to improve themselves and impact the world? On this podcast, Mabel Chan talks with tech entrepreneur, investor, and designer Richard Yan about why he left Wall Street after 10 years to start his first business at age 30.
I have always kind of known that I needed to DMOT, do my own thing. And I didn't know if I was going to do something big or something small, but I was going to take a step in the right direction.
That right direction would lead him to design 5959 Room Escape, an interactive consumer entertainment business.
It's beautiful. It gives people joy. It makes people bond with each other in a new way. It keeps them off the couches. They're moving about and thinking at the same time. And it makes them think.
Room Escape is a gaming sensation around the world, beginning with Japan in 2007. Frankly, I'd never heard of it until my friend Robbie Yan told me all about it a few months ago. I've never seen him so excited about anything else, as much as this. What's the big deal? Well, according to Harvard Business Review, the experience economy is booming beyond places like theme parks, theaters, or museums. Digital savvy consumers, especially the millennials, are demanding more dynamic, more dramatic participations during their entertainment experiences. And Room Escape plays into that. And full disclosure, the founder of Room Escape, Richard Yan, is my friend's twin brother. Richard is 31 now. He first came to America from China when he was 14. He says his parents are not rich. They need to turn to scholarship and financial aid to get him through school. Richard did not disappoint. He graduated from Dartmouth with highest honors, majoring in computer science and economics. While at Dartmouth, Richard founded a venture to help students see beneath the surface.
It's called Code Ivy, and the purpose of the website is to introduce high school students to Ivy League universities. We're trying to demystify the Ivy League experience.
In his 13-year career, Richard has worn many different hats at different times with different ideas, goals, and personalities. He started on Wall Street with Morgan Stanley, Barclays, then Goldman Sachs while pursuing an MBA degree at NYU Stern School of Business. Last year, after 10 years at Goldman, he left. He got a green card and launched 5959 Room Escape in New York. Richard Yan, welcome to One in a Billion. 你好吗? 你好.
Hey ho, hello.
Hi. I want to start with a question about your Chinese name, Ling Yan. Yan,
sure.
Is your family name, yeah?
Yes, Yan is my family name, and Ling is my given name.
And Ling means fly high? That's so aspirational and action-packed. It's a puzzle to me. Who gave you that name? What's the expectation there?
Well, so my parents jointly came up with a name. I think it was more my father's idea than my mother's. My dad actually studied in the U.S. when he was young, and then he went back to China. So I think the intention there is to basically, for me to one day fly across the Pacific Ocean and study in the U.S. or something. And my twin brother, right, was born at the same time, obviously, had a similar name, a different Chinese character, but with the similar meaning as flying high.
Did you know that growing up as a child, that was the expectation?
Right, yeah. I mean, ever since I can remember, my parents have been telling me about the meaning of my name and also telling me stories about my dad while he was studying in the U.S. We started learning English at a fairly young age as well. So, you know, that was meant to prepare us for, to be more ready to come abroad to study. So I always knew that. And that has always been part of my identity and aspiration.
What sort of stories do you remember your father telling you?
Things like how competitive it was to get in the program to go abroad to study. So back then, I think it was in the 80s, and China just started opening up to the outside world. And he was part of a very early pilot program to have Chinese students study abroad for an MBA program. And, you know, the entire program was government funded. Mm-hmm. So it was clearly a very competitive process to get in. Mm-hmm. So, and he clearly had no one to guide him in the entire process. And he had to study English himself and, you know, do well on all the exams. He's a big fan of what's happening in America. I think it's very obvious to any Chinese person that has any exposure to America that, you know, life is very, very different. The income disparity between China and America is evident. The very fact that Americans live in large houses, they all own cars, and, you know, they have top-notch education system, right? They have, like, you know, schools like Harvard, Stanford are household names in China. Mm-hmm. You know, the Ivy League system is very well known to Chinese families. Basically, from technology to business models, America basically leads the world. My dad had a very positive experience while here. He was clearly very honored and humbled being selected. It was one of the few to participate in the pilot program. And yeah, he's been telling me and my brother stories of this nature for years. Mm-hmm. Ever since during our childhood.
So that was the seed of your American dream.
I would say so, yeah. Even though many of my friends' parents have never studied in America, they know about the difference of lifestyle and the between China and America and the abundance of opportunities and the nature of a free society here in America.
Yeah.
So many families encourage their children to go abroad to study. Mm-hmm. And I think this trend has been picking up fairly quickly over the years. My story very much is a reflection of the development of China, which is very rapid in the recent decades. Mm-hmm. I actually was born in inner China. Mm. So the city is called Wuhan. And it's got the Yangtze River flowing through it. So agriculture has always been a major component for the economy of that town. Mm-hmm. And it's been a major producer of various agricultural products. During the early days of China's opening up policies under Deng Xiaoping, that particular region is not one of the beneficiaries.
Uh-huh.
So there's major income disparity between that area and the more coastal zones in China, right? Shenzhen mm-hmm. being one of the prominent examples of an area in China that became wealthier earlier than other places.
Right. It's so, the first a special economic zone.
Special economic zone, exactly. So my parents actually moved from Wuhan to Shenzhen when I was about 6 years old. I had most of my childhood in Shenzhen.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there till I was 14 years old when I came to the U.S. to study.
Shanghai may be better known in America as a cosmopolitan, sophisticated city with a long history of trade with the West. But I recently read in this book called Capitalism with Chinese Characteristics by MIT professor Ya Sheng Huang. Have you read that? He said that...
I think I might have heard the book, yeah, but I haven't read it.
Professor Huang said that Shenzhen is actually home to more highly educated private entrepreneurs than Shanghai.
I see.
So growing up in that environment, what sort of messages were you getting from society or from home that shaped your thinking about what you would do one day professionally?
Shenzhen is so dynamic. Mm. It is a, you know, it used to be a small fishing village with very, you know, little industry and not much cultural history or tradition, mm-hmm. for better or worse. And then all of a sudden it became the spotlight of the country where there's all these foreign companies coming in, forming joint ventures with local companies, giving people jobs, training people with fancy technology and advanced management techniques. Looking back, I would say one of the main messages for people in Shenzhen and also all across China, to be honest, is to make money, to become self-sufficient, to become financially independent, to be able to provide for your own children, and to be able to send your kids to great universities for great education.
For Richard, a great education would come to him at no cost. He's been a model student throughout high school, and he chose Dartmouth. Why Dartmouth? And what made him think Wall Street was a good fit after college, but not the right fit for life? At what point did you decide to move to America, and why?
I came to America when I was 14 years old, almost 15, to enter junior grade of high school. My father had always considered America as the land of opportunities and great education. So when we found out about a school in Indiana, a high school in Indiana that was very welcoming to international students, even offering financial aid and scholarships to them, we as a family decided that this was a good opportunity. To be honest, at the time, getting a U.S. visa for a high school student is extremely difficult.
Why did you think you got the visa?
Yeah, I think the visa officer was most impressed with the American English accent that we had, because most of the kids back then, they kind of study English with the British English videotapes and cassette tapes. So they don't speak the same way we do, I guess.
And how did you learn to speak with an American accent?
Right. So Family Album USA is a program recorded by an American studio, and it's a great English language learning tool. And we've been basically watching that program for quite a while, and we basically picked up this accent. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think that before we went to the consulate, my brother and I started speaking English to each other.
And it helps to have a twin brother, because technically, under the one-child policy, you're supposed to be it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I'm the elder brother, so I guess I lucked out. So I think it's really one birth policy, right? So if my parents were to have triplets, they would have let us keep them.
So now, tell me, why Dartmouth? Why did you choose to come to the East Coast?
Dartmouth is one of the ones that had a need-conscious policy, but a very, very generous need-conscious policy, meaning if you're accepted, then you're actually given a very nice, very good grant, mm-hmm. right? So we wouldn't be burdened with loans. Dartmouth is an Ivy League school. It represents American elitism. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not necessarily that I want to have to be in the elite to, and it's not that part of thinking motivated me to apply. To me, it represented excellence. Mm-hmm. It represented a challenge.
Well, let's talk about your first company. What inspired you to create 5959 Room Escape?
I have always kind of known that I needed to DMOT, do my own thing. And I wasn't, you know, I didn't know if I was going to do something big or something small, but I was going to take a step in the right direction. That's one thing. The second thing is I felt I've always been the creative type. Uh-huh. Back when I was working in finance, the things I remember most vividly are the times when I try to be creative. And the third reason being I played some other escape the room activities, and I felt like I could provide a different spin. Uh-huh. I could do something with a little more personal trait in it.
Room Escape is a super fun puzzle-solving game where a group of people try to escape from a locked room within an hour. If I were to use one word to describe our games, it would be clever. Each one follows a theme, which you'll discover as you play. Each of our rooms follows a classic story, but you don't need to...
5959 Room Escape has been called adrenaline-boosting and mind-blowing and heart-pounding. Critics and customers give it 5 stars on Yelp. Was it an instant success? from day one? Were you surprised by all the buzz?
I did the market research. It was a calculated risk, right? There's always the chance that it won't work out, but it did. And so I wasn't totally surprised because it was in line with my studies of the market.
Who are your customers?
We have all kinds of people that want to play our game. So I would say, well, if you want to look at the stats, interestingly, 75% of the people that make the booking are actually women.
Wow.
I think that, yeah, I think that the females are, they're just very curious and interested in this type of activity for whatever reason. But in terms of the demographics, we probably cater mostly to 20 to 40-year-old age range. Uh-huh. And we've had individuals as well as companies want to do their team building exercise here. They want to do their end of year party here. We've done some dating events.
Uh-huh,
so
wow.
Single guys and gals get together. It's an easy way to break the ice, right? You're trapped in a room solving puzzles together. We're also doing something called Escape with the Stars.
Uh-huh.
It's a recruiting event. So students and professionals get together and solve puzzles. And it's a fun way for students to get close to employees at companies of their dreams at zero distance, right? And then we do a career panel discussion right after the event to help them, you know, talk about business.
You mentioned corporate clients. Who are these corporate clients and how does it work for team building?
Companies include, you know, Google, Macy's, JetBlue, American Express, Victoria's Secret, Morgan Stanley. They send the, you know, a team of people here, and so they're divided into different rooms, and they would play just like normal customers. But I think there's a particular team bonding side to it because these guys work together, but they don't see another side of them,
uh-huh,
their colleagues outside of work. So this
see.
Is a fun way to do it. Just an alternative to going to a bar and singing karaoke, for example.
I see. Now, how did you design something like this? Can you describe the process?
I think that it's similar to composing a piece of music or writing a book.
Mm-hmm.
You have some notion of what you want to do, but it's very abstract at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just kind of chip away at it. And at some point, it just comes together.
What is step number one?
I think step number one is to think of a type of puzzle. A puzzle is basically a question, right?
Mm-hmm.
But how do you frame that question? You don't want it to seem like a mundane question. You want it to be an interesting question. And the question can be presented in many different ways. It could be a sound. It could be a smell. It could be something visual,
mm-hmm,
right? It could be printed on paper. It could be sculpted in, you know, plastic. It could be like a jigsaw piece. It could be many things.
Well, let me ask the question this way. We know Room Escape first started in Japan. When you first decided to put your own spin to this game, what sort of value or impact do you want to add?
I think my Room Escape takes on the genre in a slightly different angle. It requires a little more thinking. All the answers are connected with a common theme. So, for example, we have the Hound of the Baskervilles, which is a Sherlock Holmes story.
Mm-hmm.
So basically everything in that room is connected to that story somehow. So I think the value that we're trying to add is to have people play the game in a slightly more intellectual context. They like it. It gives people joy. It makes people bond with each other in a new way. It keeps them off the couches. They're moving about and thinking at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes them think. I believe anything that makes people think is a form of education.
I read that you enjoyed playing all types of puzzles as a child. Word, math, mechanical, detective fiction, mystery novels. How did you find all these games to play in Shenzhen?
China does have toys and books and so on back then. And, you know, as any responsible parent would do, my mom and my dad accommodated my interest in these things and purchased them for me. Yeah. And as I was saying, I was very much a geek, a nerd when I was young. So a lot of things I like tend to gravitate towards a more intellectual flavor. And there were a lot of those things for kids in Shenzhen.
Entrepreneurship isn't for everyone. For Richard Yan, it's been 10 years in the making and constant soul searching. beginning back in the days of college. Your first job out of college was at a startup called Code Ivy. How did you get that job?
Actually, that was something I started while in college.
Ah.
So, yeah, I wouldn't call it a job. It was just a website that my friend and I started to introduce high school students to Ivy League universities.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Code Ivy because we're trying to demystify the Ivy League experience.
From Code Ivy, you jumped ship to Wall Street, Morgan Stanley, Barclays, and then Goldman Sachs for 10 years. Why investment banking?
Right. Investment banking is a highly coveted corporate job opportunity for any Ivy League graduate those days.
Mm-hmm.
And it was coveted, but also sort of a default option for people that don't exactly know what they want to do.
Really?
I think, you know, getting an offer from any of these places is a dream come true for people. And, you know, luckily I was one of them, and I just decided to embark on this journey.
Now, why did you leave Goldman? Was it not a good fit?
No, Goldman was a great experience. So I was there for a long time, since 2007 to 2015.
Mm-hmm.
But deep down, I always knew I wanted to do my own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and Goldman has a very strict policy about not having their employees put on other hats outside of work.
What would be the highlights of your time? 10 years is the longest time you've stayed with one position, as far as I know.
I would say my best experience is probably working with some of the most brilliant people I've met in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So the traders, the strategists at Goldman in particular are really top-notch. Mm-hmm. They have great market instincts. They come up with ideas quickly, they verbalize them well, and they are great at executing.
Mm-hmm.
They're extremely hardworking, mm-hmm. and they're good team players.
Right.
So basically, to learn about being a good professional team worker, there's really no better place.
Mm-hmm.
And I really appreciate that experience.
Now, was there a trigger when you know that's the time now to leave? And how did you know?
I'm not sure if there's just one trigger. It kind of happened over time.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, my first few years at Goldman, I was learning extensively. I was building networks,
mm-hmm.
and I felt I was growing. But mm-hmm. towards later times, I think, you know, at any given point in time, we as human beings all want to grow and mm-hmm. satisfy our desires for mm-hmm. further development.
Yep.
And I felt that, you know, I reached a certain point that I needed to go ahead and do my own thing.
As you moved around from city to city, school to school, and job to job, what moves you? What would you say is the core and center of why you would invest your creative mind with your time or your money?
I don't remember the exact name of the pyramid, but there's the Maslow's desire pyramid.
Right, the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? It's this theory in psychology proposed by Abraham Maslow in his 1943 paper, A Theory of Human Motivation.
Right, right. Yes, exactly. Once you're satisfied at the lower level, then you go up to a higher level.
Yes.
And I felt that the highest level is self-realization or self-actualization.
Mm.
And I felt that I have obtained various things in life, and I felt very lucky for doing so.
Mm-hmm.
But what I have not done is a form of self-expression. It's going out there, doing something on my own, creating something from scratch, and having the final product very much reflect who I am. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine recently said to me he wants to define his existence in doing a startup, mm-hmm. because he wants to basically have that, you know, be his very own product. And that very much resonated with my drive, I feel.
Now that in China, the entrepreneurial scene is booming, do you feel a gravitational pull to go back and do something there?
Oh, yeah, all the time. I mean, so China has changed drastically since I left, right? I mean, I go back once a year, once every 2 years, and mm-hmm. every time I go back, it's a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
So the rising middle class, the large consumer demand call for many, many different types of businesses. Mm-hmm. And I'm very excited about that change. Mm-hmm. That being said, I think there's some fundamental differences between the U.S. and China that make me feel that I would probably be better off pursuing opportunities in America for now.
Now, how is the difference bad for your business?
Well, because since I'm educated in the U.S., I think of certain things as normal and certain cultural customs as socially acceptable. For instance, right, we did a business partnership with a group of Chinese students out here, mm-hmm. And I think the way the business was done on their end, I would have thought that they could have conducted it a little more professionally.
Do you keep a finger on the pulse of innovation and entrepreneurship in China?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Where are the sweet spots?
I would say that China is intensely competitive. So, like, for example, Groupon tried to enter China, mm-hmm. and there were 5,000 copycats.
Wow.
So imagine 5,000 Groupons in China all competing for this market.
Wow.
So I would say if someone wants to do something great in China, whatever product it is, it needs to have some kind of technological barrier, because anything else would just get copied instantly.
Mm-hmm.
Another example is the peer-to-peer loan lending platform.
Yes.
So there are companies in China that specialize in building peer-to-peer loan lending websites,
uh-huh.
for entrepreneurs that want to enter this market. And, you know, you hear about hundreds of these businesses failing over mm-hmm. a period of 6 months to a year. So anyway, the bottom line is, I think the sweet spot would be something technologically significant.
I read that a major goal in your business school education was to learn how you can bring capital to China. Is that your Chinese dream?
That could be a component of a Chinese dream. So the idea of bringing capital to China is basically identifying areas of growth, mm-hmm. and, you know, have your capital grow alongside it. I think that that business model is very interesting, because nowadays there are actually some people doing it the other way around. I've actually seen people that bring capital from China to America. I've seen Chinese investors in Detroit, in Portugal, in, you know, Chinese government building roads in Africa, all different places.
Although recently there is capital outflow problem that the government is trying to address and perhaps curb.
That's correct. There's a imminent danger of the RMB being devalued,
mm-hmm.
Or depreciated, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And the government is trying to contain the capital within China, because much needed capital for growth, once they leave the country, it can be detrimental to the economy. I think the biggest challenge right now is, can China basically transform from an investment-heavy economy to consumption-heavy economy? That is the key.
Now, you said after turning 30 and after getting married, you became more mature and somehow found the courage to be more true to yourself.
I think as a single guy in New York City, committing yourself to your partner for life actually takes a lot of courage. So basically being able to make that kind of commitment is a big step forward,
mm-hmm.
for a single man.
Mm-hmm.
I think this coincided with the time I'm turning 30 years old. Just being in a loving relationship, having someone that supports you and loves you is, you know, a good way for you to focus on the right things.